From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Flint's emergency manager proposes cutting 36 police and 19 firefighter jobs. Flint's mayor says, let's find a way to save those jobs.
In this situation, almost 3 years under state receivership, there is absolutely a state role in the solution.
We get the latest on Lansing's efforts to repair our crumbling roads.
You've got to get enough Republicans, especially in the Senate, where some of them are facing primary challenges, to support some type of what is essentially a tax hike.
And we discover Michigan's tribute to war dogs.
World War II is estimated that they saved 15,000 lives. So that's 15,000 men and women in uniform and would not have come home if it wasn't for a war dog.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. The Severstal steel plant in Dearborn has been cited 37 times for violating its current state air quality permit. Well, now the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality says it set the standard some too high. Two Detroit lawmakers are asking the EPA to step in. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, we'll hear more about what the recent permitting process could mean for the people who live around the Severstal plant. Then later this hour, we'll check in with the veterans and dog lovers who have joined forces to honor the state's war dogs. But first, to all sorts of political news coming out of Lansing and Detroit, from the political fate of a longtime Michigan congressman to a political move by a top Republican to derail a ballot proposal that would boost Michigan's minimum wage, and news on that perennial Michigan topic, repairing our potholed, crumbling roads. So much political news that Michigan Radio's It's Just Politics hosts are here, Rick Pluta and Zoe Clark. Hello to you both.
Hello.
Hello.
So let us begin with the latest on Detroit Congressman John Conyers and what should have been a no-brainer for someone who was first elected to Congress in 1965, which is getting enough signatures on his ballot petition. Zoe, what's the latest?
Hello.
Hello.
So let us begin with the latest on Detroit Congressman John Conyers and what should have been a no-brainer for someone who was first elected to Congress in 1965, which is getting enough signatures on his ballot petition. Zoe, what's the latest?
The latest is it appears like longtime Congressman John Conyers may not make it on the ballot. We heard late last week the clerk saying he does not have enough signatures. This is how it works. April 22nd, there was a deadline that said if you want to run for Congress, you need to collect at least 1,000 legal valid signatures of voters saying, yes, we want you to run. The congressman did turn in those signatures. The issue was whether they were valid, whether they were legal. It turns out two folks who were out trying to get those signatures actually were not registered voters themselves.
Or appear to not be registered.
This
right.
is still sort of the sticky situation
Conyers
whether they
legal
were
team
or weren't.
Is contesting that.
And as Rick mentions, legal teams contesting this now. This will also continue to be contested sort of at every level.
What's supposed to happen next is that the Wayne County clerk will make her official determination, and we expect it will be that he's roughly 400 signatures short, and then that they could then take it to the Michigan Secretary of State, and then after that to the courts. And the strategy is really just it's a very mundane review of every single signature to try and resurrect enough of them to get Conyers over that 1,000 legal signature line so that he can appear on the ballot. But that doesn't mean that they're not already trying to figure out what a plan B might be.
And we've heard the talk write-in campaign. Rick, how successful do you think a write-in campaign could be for John Conyers?
Well, John Conyers certainly has the name ID to pull off something like a write-in campaign. The question is whether or not someone who was unable to pull together the infrastructure to get the proper number of petition mm-hmm. signatures to get on the ballot, whether or not he'd be capable or the people around him would be capable of putting together a campaign to get enough people to write in his name.
Exactly.
We saw from Mike Duggan that it can be done.
We
just don't know if John Conyers is capable of doing it. And, even if he doesn't, he could you know, then conceivably be nominated by a third party in order to get on the November ballot.
But has the prospect that this 24-term congressman might not be on the November ballot, has this gotten people thinking about other candidates? Is anyone going, hey, look at me?
Well, actually, it's gotten candidates sort of banging their head against the wall saying, why didn't I think of because of this April 22nd deadline? In fact, there were quite a few people looking at that race, but this is an issue that the congressman, longtime congressman, people out of respect for many different reasons felt like they weren't ready to challenge him. There is one challenger, Horace Sheffield.
Well, there are also a lot of people who just didn't – basically, the wherewithal wasn't there because, you know, Detroit just went through a big, brutal, expensive mayoral campaign, and just everyone's kind of tapped. And so there was sort of this sense of he'll serve out another 2 years and then, you know, and then we'll see what happens. And it was a chance for Conyers to have his victory lap, that he was going to become the dean of the House when John Dingell retired.
Well, next up, we look at the ballot proposal that would raise the state minimum wage to $10.10 an hour by 2017 and then index it to inflation thereafter. Rick, tell us what Senate Majority Leader Randy Richardville is proposing.
Well, he came up with kind of a crafty little maneuver that the law that would be changed by this initiative, amended by this citizen initiative, he introduced a bill to repeal it and basically take what is substantially the same, you know, existing minimum wage law and just bring it back as a new public act. And the idea is that just maybe that would preempt this ballot drive, make it all null and void because the law that they're trying to change is no longer there. Now, there is still a lot of questions, though, as to whether that even works and whether or not it can forestall a petition drive getting a question on the ballot.
Well, Zoe, okay, tell me if I'm seeing this wrong. Citizen Group is out gathering voter signatures on a ballot proposal that would let us as voters vote yes or no on whether to raise the minimum wage. And Senator Richardville has decided he would rather short circuit that process, basically cut the legs out from under this voter initiated proposal and perhaps produce an outcome more that business would be happier with?
Absolutely. I mean, that is what's going on. Another issue that's going on is I think Republicans and the GOP looked at this ballot, had it, and maybe it still will go on the ballot come November, looked at it and saw it has a really, really high approval rating. This idea of increasing the state's minimum wage to $10.10 has a lot of popular support, which would then most likely boost voter turnout come November. Democrats have a voter turnout issue in midterm elections when a president is not at the top of the ballot. Republicans turn out, Democrats don't. This was a hope among Democrats to get their base out and vote. So not only is this an issue about increasing the minimum wage, it becomes an issue that if this is suddenly a moot point on the ballot, are you not going to see as many Democrats, as many progressives out and voting? So it's sort of two birds with one stone, you know, by the GOP.
And now to our not so beloved roads and highways in Michigan. Rick, what's the latest on getting funding for road repairs?
Well, we had a package that cleared the State House last week, and it was bipartisan, although not universally embraced. But really now it moves over to the Senate, where the heavy lifting is going to take place, that Randy Richardville, who we were just talking about, has said that the Senate will go and come up with the almost $1 billion additional dollars that's needed to meet Governor Snyder's road funding target of $1.2 billion a year. And so they're busy trying to craft a revenue package that they can get Republicans behind and they can get Democrats behind. And it's a, you know, it's a big complicated matter that they're hoping to get done either before or at least no later than early June.
So that state House legislation was just about $450 million, Zoe. So it seems like lawmakers in the House shouldn't be patting themselves on the back for passing this legislation since it is so far short of what is needed.
It's very far short of what Governor Snyder has said, that he wants this $1.2 billion annually. Mm-hmm. And this is the amount that Jace Bulger, the Republican Speaker of the House, came up with, got it passed, as we saw, very, very quickly. Mm-hmm. Once he sort of put his foot behind what he wanted to happen, it happened.
It happened.
I think you're exactly right. And you've got Democrats going, hey, why should we, you know, even be for this when it's not going to put what we think is enough money? Why should we be for this sort of what they think is not a permanent, absolutely best solution, and will then sort of make voters think, well, we did something, and then the idea of getting that $1.2 billion suddenly becomes less important because, oh, we put half a billion in.
Potentially take the pressure off. The political game, while very complex, can probably be boiled down to this, which is you've got to get enough Republicans, especially in the Senate, where some of them are facing primary challenges, to support some type of what is essentially a tax hike mm-hmm. in order to come up with more revenue for roads. And you've got to convince Democrats to help them make up whatever gap they might have because of that. And the Democrats are going to be concerned that Republicans will use a tax hike against them in a general election. So that's the political equation that you've got to fill in the numbers.
It's something very interesting that Rick and I have talked often about, that usually going into an election year, particularly the summer before an election mm-hmm. year, lawmakers want to go and campaign on tax cuts and how we're saving you money. And here we're going into the summer before an election where we're talking about increasing transportation funding. And let's also remember, tomorrow we're going to be talking a lot about this Detroit settlement money yeah. from Lansing going to Detroit. Right. So it's this interesting dynamic. Usually around this time we hear cuts and we're giving you money back. And mm-hmm. now it's, hey, state putting out some bucks.
But interestingly,
and not only that, it's kind of funny that we're not hearing just that. But there are certainly some Republicans who still want to, you know, go back to their districts and campaign on delivering a tax cut. But there's some who are being told, don't come back with a modest tax cut if you have not fixed my roads, mm-hmm. that lawmakers could be punished for cutting taxes if they don't deal with the road problem.
Well, in fact, I was thinking of the fact we talked with the folks from the Center for Michigan mm-hmm. when they took their voter initiative. They sat down with so many Michigan voters yeah. all around the state who said, go ahead, I'll pay more for better roads. Yeah. I don't care. I don't want to hear about tax cuts. Exactly.
Exactly. And but, so I think this is actually a consequence of that enough people got in touch with their lawmakers. And, hey, enough lawmakers drove on the roads themselves and realized how bad things were. You know, after years and years of cuts, mm-hmm. I think we're starting to see whether or not it's a big push for tax revenue or anything like that. After years and years of cuts, we are starting to see some money being put back into mm-hmm. some basic infrastructure.
Carpe diem. Zoe Clark and Rick Pluta, hosts of It's Just Politics, right here on Michigan Radio. As always, thank you so much.
Thank you, Cindy.
You betcha.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. While the debate over transportation funding continues this week in Lansing, a recent report finds most states are spending more to build new roads than they are to repair the crumbling roads they've already got. But the study from the nonpartisan budget watchdog group Taxpayers for Common Sense finds that there are exceptions, including Michigan. We pay a significant percentage of road money for repairs. Steve Ellis is the vice president of Taxpayers for Common Sense. Good to have you with us.
Thanks a lot for having me. Glad to be here.
So this report called Repair Priorities 2014, you did it in conjunction with Smart Growth America. Just exactly what were you just examining?
Well, this is kind of follow-on to a report we did a few years ago, also looking at this. And what we're looking at is how much is being spent on expanding the system and how much is actually being spent on repairing what we already have. And unfortunately, what we found is, if you look at it across the country, you had from 2009 to 2011, states, all 50 states, spent more than $20 billion on expanding road capacity and only spent $16.5 billion on repairing and preserving what we already have, which is 99% of the system. And the problem with that is going to end up being is that, you know, we're our roads are getting more and more of our roads are falling from good down to poor condition, and we're not actually improving the system, and while we're adding actually more to the backlog of repairs.
Why do you think this is? Is it sexier for our legislators to point to a great new stretch of freeway than it is to, you know, point to repairs?
Yeah, I think that, you know, I mean, it's a better ribbon cutting, you know, and you have got a brand new piece of asphalt laying out there, and you can talk about how this is going to change traffic patterns or improve flow. But in reality, that is often not the case. It's a little bit less sexy to, fill in potholes or to deal with, repairing roads and moving something from poor to fair or fair to good. So I think absolutely, you know, I don't think roads are ever that sexy, but, you know, certainly that does play into it.
Now, just so we're clear, are you talking about using federal dollars?
It's a mix. You know,
okay.
I mean, basically you have, you know, we all pay the gas tax that then funds into federal coffers that then gets redistributed back out to the states for road and transit projects. But then also most states have their own state gas tax as well that also helps fund this work. So it's a mix.
So you did find a few exceptions, states spending a hefty chunk of road money on repairs. And lo and behold, here's Michigan spending 87% of its funding on repairs, along with North Dakota, Nebraska, Maine, and Wyoming. So why do you think we're so far ahead of the other 45 states?
Well, they're making good decisions. Also, you know, there's a lot of challenges in Michigan as far as keeping roads in good condition. And as a matter of fact, even though they had committed so much of their resources, and we certainly applaud the state on doing this, you still had fewer roads in good condition than you did just a few years ago, and more roads in poor condition. You can only imagine what it would have been like had that money not been being spent that way.
Wow, because I'm going to tell you, most drivers in the state would then ask, why is it so hard to see the effects of that money spent on repairs? So, separate from this bumper crop of potholes from this winter, before all of this, our roads, everybody felt, were in pretty rotten shape.
Right. Well, you know, and this is only takes you basically through 2011, because that was the most recent data that we could actually get. So, yeah, I mean, there's going to be some of these issues, and there is a gap. There is a gap between what is actually being spent and how much repair is needed, not just in Michigan, but across the country. And that's something that taxpayers in the country is going to have to grapple with. You know, we've got a bigger road appetite and than we actually have a stomach for that, those taxes and spending.
So your message is that money has to come from somewhere. So even, for example, if here we are, state of Michigan, with 87% of road repair as a percent of the total, that's pretty high. But that amount is still too small to get the job done.
Well, it certainly, you know, appears that way, and that's going to be a real challenge. Are we going to cut back? You know, I mean, one of the things that some states have done is look at, well, are all these roads necessary to be, you know, maintained as part of the state or the federal system? In some cases, should these be devolved down to the local level? Also, in other cases, looking at, does it make sense to have asphalt or certain rural roads that could be dirt or graded? You know, you see that a lot in states like Vermont, which is also a leader in this area. So those are real questions that I think that policymakers and drivers are going to have to grapple with.
So I guess based on what you've seen, talk about Michigan, what more should be done to make noticeable progress in repairing roads?
Well, you know, the other thing is, and we didn't get as much into this because we're looking more at the aggregate numbers, but I think that if you bore down it in the state of Michigan, some of it's going to be, how do you target the money? You know, are you targeting it at where it has the most, you're going to get the most bang for your buck, where there are, you know, roads that are in disrepair, but that we can make a strategic investment so it doesn't fall from fair to poor, you know, that we're not going to have an even bigger investment, because that's one of the issues is that once a road degrades significantly, it is a lot more costly to move it back into the good condition. It's a lot easier to keep good roads in good condition than it is to take a poor road and move it into a good condition. So it is going to be about targeting those investments, and I think that's where, you know, there's not a lot of room to grow, if you would, in Michigan from 87%. I mean, certainly they could go a little bit higher, but that's pretty much almost all your investment is going into repair.
It sounds like there's kind of a call to action for concerned drivers and taxpayers in your report as well, to let lawmakers know what they want in terms of roads.
Yeah, I think that it's important, and I mean we're a budget watchdog group across the board. We think it's important for drivers, taxpayers, and citizens to engage their elected officials and really sort of drive that, no pun intended, that point home that, you know, we need to repair and maintain what we have and do that in an effective manner, invest, you know, smartly and appropriately, rather than just, you know, creating ribbon-cutting ceremonies for public officials.
The report is called Repair Priorities 2014, done by Smart Growth America and by Taxpayers for Common Sense. And we've been talking to Steve Ellis, the Vice President of Taxpayers for Common Sense. Thanks so much, Steve.
Thanks a lot for having me.
When you think of a war hero, What image comes to your mind? Most likely, it could be a man or a woman dressed in desert camo, or a wounded warrior learning to walk again after being wounded in an IED blast. But there is another group of war heroes we should consider, war dogs. Their history in our military is long and honored. Messenger dogs, scout or patrol dogs, and particularly important in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, explosive detection dogs. And perhaps you didn't know this, Michigan has one of the few war dog memorials in the nation. It's located between Milford and South Lyon in Oakland County. Phil Waitloff is a veteran of the U.S. Army, and he's a champion of the Michigan War Dog Memorial. Phil, is there any way to estimate just how many American military lives have been saved by war dogs?
Yes. Really, if you go back to the little bit of the history of canines in the military, you kind of can start back at World War One. During that time, the dogs were called ambulance dogs. Mm. And after there was a frontal attack in no man's land, the dogs were trained to go out into no man's land, find a wounded soldier, bring back an article of his clothing to the stretcher bearers, and then lead them back to that wounded soldier and bring him back to safety. How many lives did they save during World War One? Well, I guess only God would know.
Yes.
But
they were important in World War II, weren't they?
Yes, in World War II, is estimated, according to military records, that they saved 15,000 lives. So that's 15,000 men and women in uniform and would not have come home if it wasn't for a war dog. And in Vietnam, they're credited with saving 10,000 lives. And then after that, their name changed to MWDs. That's military working dog, because of the different disciplines that they were now being trained at. So they did their duty in Bosnia. They did their duty in Iraq. And today, they are still on duty in Afghanistan. At the present time, I believe there's 600 teams in Afghanistan. And their main function there is finding the explosives, the IEDs on the road. Matter of fact, they're so good at it than what they call the hot spots on certain trails and roads, they will actually lead a convoy of vehicles. They'll go ahead of them and clear the road.
Wow.
They do a fantastic job, and it's something that people are not aware of. There's not been a lot of publicity about it, but we need to honor these dogs and show our respect for what they've done and how many lives they've saved. So.
And tell us how you found out about the War Dog Memorial in Michigan.
That was just by chance. Somebody had mentioned to me about an abandoned pet cemetery and a war dog monument out in this wooded area. It was in absolutely horrible shape. And so being a member of the AMVETS Post 2006 out of Milford, I went back to the meeting that month and I told the guys what I had found. And formed a detail. So let's form a detail to start cleaning this up. So we set a date, put some notice in the paper, contacted other VSOs, that's Veterans Service Organizations, and canine supporters alike. And the day that we set to start cleaning it up, over 50 people showed up. It was just astounding. Everybody had heard about this abandoned pet cemetery, but nobody had done anything with it. So we started cleaning it up, and at that point, we started doing some research. So we got into the archives to find out more about this pet cemetery and about why the War Dog Monument was erected. And we found that the pet cemetery was established in 1936, and at that time, it was called the Happy Hunting Grounds Pet Memorial. And then we found that in 1946... when the townspeople heard about how many lives canines had saved during World War II, they got together with a fundraiser and they erected that monument to honor them. And then in 1947 was actually the first war dog that was buried there.
Yeah, tell us about Sparks.
Yeah, Sergeant Sparks, he was a Doberman Pinscher, and he fought with the Marine Corps in the Pacific as they was doing their island hopping. And we found that he fought in Bougainville, he fought in Guadalcanal, in Guam, and Okinawa. So this dog went through four major campaigns and brought everybody home safe. And the handler asked permission to take him home with him. Mm-hmm. At first, the military denied it because they felt he was too dangerous. But he wrote them a two-page letter and took full responsibility, brought him home to Rochester Hills, Michigan. And a year later, he got ill and he passed away.
Wow.
So he said, I want to take him out to the pet cemetery by the monument, and I want to bury him just like his buddies that died on the beach. So it was very, very, very heart-touching.
And you were actually able, were you not, Phil, to get Governor Snyder to declare March 13th official Canine Veterans Day in Michigan?
Yes, that was very interesting. We after we cleaned it up, we had a kind of a rededication of the site. And we said to ourselves, we should do this every year, have some kind of a ceremony. And so one of our guys said, well, why don't we write a proclamation and submit it to Governor Snyder and see if we'll sign for it. And then we said, what date? Well, we knew in March 13th in 1942, the quartermaster was given the order to secure dogs for defense. So we said, let's use that date, March 13th. So we submitted that to Governor Snyder, and within 2 weeks, he signed that proclamation. But we went one step further. We took a copy of that signed proclamation, and we sent it to every single governor in the United States. And it was interesting, the response. Some was no response, but other ones was, this is a great idea. Hmm. So we have encouraged 13 states now to sign up for that.
So you've led the way. This is really, seems to me, a true case of military veterans like yourself and fellow members of your VFW hall to be caring for other veterans, four-legged veterans.
Well, that's of course, one of our missions. The VSO's mission is veterans helping veterans. And when and with me being a dog lover and always having German Shepherds most of my life, it kind of touched my heart of how well-trained these dogs were and how dedicated they were. And the bonding that would happen between the soldier and his dog, it's just unbelievable. As many nights I've sat and talked to the Vietnam Dog Handlers Group and talked to these soldiers who've been on the front lines with a scout dog. They're always on point. It's the most dangerous spot you can be in a patrol. And the stories they tell you, it's just phenomenal. And I said, we have got to honor these dogs. We've got to take care of them.
So are you accepting, are you burying more of these war dogs?
Yes. Last year we buried two. We buried a MWD buddy. We did a very, very nice ceremony for him. Then right after MWD buddy, we buried MWD Mina. Now, Mina's story is very, very touching. He was originally trained in the U.K., and he fought with the British Army for 2 years, and he did two tours in Bosnia. Then after that, he was transferred to the American Army. We're not sure why, but he was transferred to the American Army. And then he went down to Lackland Air Force Base for refresher training, and then he was assigned to Fort Linwood, Missouri, as his home base. And then he did 9 tours in Afghanistan. That's
wow.
9 tours.
Wow.
That's just unheard of. But the dog was so good at a bomb detection dog, they did not want to let him go. And they worked him till he was 12 years old, and finally his hips started giving out. So the young soldier, who was his handler, had first shot at adopting him, and which he did. And he sent him home to his family in Owosso, Michigan. And poor Mina only lasted about a year, and he got very ill, and he died. On May 5th, we had Mina's burial, and we set it up real proper this time. We had the Patriot Guard was there, did a flag line, and we ended the program with the group that I belong to. We're all German Shepherd owners. We have 8 German Shepherds that's been trained to howl on command. So the end of burial, we said, it would be a canine salute to their fallen comrade. And we lined up those 8 shepherds, and they howled for 15 minutes.
Wow.
And it was very touching.
I'm glad we had a chance to learn about all of this, Phil. And I want to remind everybody that the Michigan War Dog Memorial can be found at 11 Mile and Milford Roads right near South Lyon, Michigan. And you can learn more about the Michigan War Dog Memorial by going to their website, mwdm.org. That's mwdm.org. And we've been talking to the director of the Michigan War Dog Memorial and a proud U.S. Army veteran, Phil Whiteloff. It's been very good to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Well, you're more than welcome.
Welcome back to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It was June 2012 when Governor Rick Snyder and Michael Finney, the CEO for the Michigan Economic Development Corporation, attended a ceremony at the Severstal Steel Plant in Dearborn. The two spoke with then-plant manager Sergei Kuznetsov. A Detroit Free Press investigation now raises questions about what happened after that conversation in the summer of 2012. Keith Matheny is a writer with the Detroit Free Press. Keith, welcome back.
Great to be with you.
So before we talk about what happened after that June 2012 meeting, tell us about the Severstal plant and its history in Dearborn.
Well, Severstal is a Russian company, and it's one of the world's largest in the areas of mining and metals. And it created the factory there in Dearborn when it purchased the nearly century-old Rouge Steel Plant out of bankruptcy in 2004. And they manufacture flat-rolled carbon steel products, mostly for the automotive industry, but also other industries.
And was there not a sense of, wow, hooray, it was saved, you know, those jobs were saved, because it looked like that plant was going to go away until the Russians came in, correct?
Oh, yes, there absolutely was. And since their involvement, they've invested more than $1 billion in diversifying the activities at the plant, and including what's known as bag houses, which are a means of capturing some of the particulate pollution, dust-type pollution that would otherwise go up the smokestacks. So there was an effort made to improve environmental processes there, but also to diversify what they were able to do for their customers.
So I guess we could establish they're a big player as far as Michigan businesses in terms of jobs and investment, but they are also known as one of the state's biggest industrial polluters, correct?
Yes, they are considered a major air polluter by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, routinely have some of the highest levels of like the metal manganese, the particulate matter that we mentioned earlier, lead, things like that. They're definitely, you know, considered sort of a top 5, top 10 polluter in the state. And of course, this is in an area of Southeast Michigan where there's a number of industrial activities, the Marathon refinery, mm-hmm. a number of other steel plants. It's a pretty beleaguered area in terms of air quality for the people who live around it.
I know your piece in the Free Press noted that the Department of Environmental Quality, the DEQ, hit Severstal with a letter of violation back in February 2009, and they'd only taken over the plant in 2004. So this does go back a ways.
Indeed it does. And over the last few years, there have been something on the order of 24 notices of violation of air quality standards, both at the state level and at the federal EPA level. Indeed, what is prompting this consideration of revising the Severstal permit was they evaluated the smokestack activity and determined that a number of different pollutants were being emitted on a continual basis at far greater levels than that 2006 permit allowed.
So take us to the summer of 2012. It's the ceremony unveiling the revamping of the plant, and Governor Snyder's there. So is the CEO of the Michigan Economic Development Corporation, Michael Finney. And they have FaceTime with the plant manager at the time, who was Sergei Kuznetsov. What do we know about what they've talked about?
Their reaction to learning that these emissions were coming out at far greater levels than the permit allowed was to try to devise a way to revise the permit so that it allowed the levels of actual emission. Sort of like, say you're a motorist who routinely does 75 miles per hour in mm-hmm. a 55 mile per hour zone. Their move was to try to get the speed limit lifted up to the amount that they were speeding, if you will. So Mr. Kuznetsov, according to emails we obtained from the Michigan Economic Development Corporation, which is Governor Snyder's business promoting agency, and Amy Banninga, who's sort of the state business ombudsman, or at least was at the time, mm-hmm. for MEDC, she laid out in an email that got forwarded to DEQ that Mr. Finney had talked with Mr. Kuznetsov, who laid out his concerns about the permitting, his concerns about EPA getting involved, and that he wanted the permit. His word was grandfathered, which means he wanted to revise the 2006 permit, but keep 2006 air quality regulations as the rule of the day, rather than open the factory up to modern pollution regs, which are quite a bit stricter.
In your piece, you write that that the DEQ called Severstal, and here was the quote, the most egregious facility in the state with a total disregard for the air quality requirements, and that end quote. And that was August of 2012. And now we're learning the DEQ has indeed agreed to revise the air quality permits for Severstal, that the, saying the old permits set unreasonable standards. Here is Lynn Fiedler with the DEQ.
They could not comply, and now we are working to make sure that they have a permit that reflects their operations and the one that we can make sure they comply with and enforce.
So they're going to change the past requirements and lower them to please Severstal?
Well, it appears they're going to allow them essentially to pollute. It's kind of funny because you say pollute more, but they're actually polluting at the same levels they have been. Those levels were just violating their permit in the past, and now they've revised the permit to reflect the pollution. There was a memo that Severstal's top executives delivered to the DEQ in September 2012 where they laid out their concerns about what would happen if they had to comply with modern pollution regulations. And they were just basically really concerned about the huge expense that would be involved if they had to use, there are things called lowest achievable emission rate or best available control technology. These are federal requirements that can sometimes kick in, and it basically means you have to use the best technology available to provide the most pollution relief to the neighborhood that you can, and they flat out were seeking to avoid that, obviously for monetary reasons, but if you talk to the folks who live in this area, who are sort of beset by pollution from all sides,
yes,
they would say, I think you need to use the best available control technology. And I'm questioning why the state's environmental regulator doesn't think so.
When you think that this is an agency that's supposed to be protecting the best interest of Michigan citizens, and you think of the air that these people who live in that 48217 zip code are breathing, like who's going to bat for these people?
Well, I certainly understand that the Michigan Economic Development Corporation is all about business promotion, but DEQ obviously has to balance a number of different concerns, and certainly you would hope one of them is what's happening with the neighborhoods.
But looking at this newest development with the DEQ changing, correcting those past requirements, how much of a course change is this based on the documents and the violation citations that you reviewed from the DEQ about Severstal?
The DEQ in their announcement that they were approving the revised permit basically said, and I'm paraphrasing here, yes, there have been a number of violations in the past, but that's the past. We're looking to the present and the future now. But if you stop and think about it, they haven't really addressed the issue of increased pollutants. They've addressed the permit sort of bureaucracy here, and I don't know how that's necessarily providing relief to the area.
Keith, what reaction did your story have at the state level?
There were certainly a couple of lawmakers who got animated about it. Rashida Tlaib, who represents an area, she's a state representative who represents an area that frequently encounters these sorts of pollution, industrial types of activities.
Pet coke piles,
yes, and some of the air quality issues as well. She and another lawmaker were asking that the U.S. EPA kind of step in and take the lead here. I don't know what's going to become of that, but they absolutely are concerned about it.
So this is really still unfolding in a sense, because as word now comes out about the DEQ revising air quality permits, what reaction do you think that might draw?
Well, it's certainly going to be interesting to see. I know the EPA later this year, I believe in December, is going to issue new designations for particulate matter pollution. This is the fine dust that the industry can obviously be a major contributor to. And it could very well find, because the air quality standard has been revised so that a lower threshold equals that you're not in attainment with the Federal Clean Air Act. So they very well could find that this zone that includes where Severstal's plant is does not meet the air quality standard, and that could kick in a number of requirements for emitters, including Severstal. So it's an ongoing situation, and I don't imagine that this is the end of it.
Detroit Free Press staff writer Keith Matheny, his piece for the Free Press basically asking the question, did the state agency lobby to bend the rules on pollutants at this Dearborn steel mill? Keith, always good to talk with you. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Flint's state-appointed emergency manager is proposing a $55 million budget that would cut 36 police officer positions and 19 firefighter jobs. Darnell Early's two-year budget plan also includes higher fees for property owners for street lighting, garbage pickup, and water and sewer service. Dane Walling, the mayor of Flint, has some concerns. Mayor, you and I have talked a number of times on Stateside about Flint's problems and its needs, and you have always been crystal clear that, if anything, your city needs more police and more firefighters.
We have to have a strong public safety system in Flint. We've been, unfortunately, one of the communities with the highest per capita rate of violent crime. We just have to be honest about dealing with that. Now, there is also no debate about the city of Flint's financial challenges, and those are well known and well documented. So we have to make, you know, every effort while we go from a proposed budget to an adopted budget to maintain that strong public safety system and police and fire protection services.
What was your gut response when that budget was put down on the table and you saw called for cutting 36 police and 19 fire jobs?
Yeah, it hurt. And it's in response to the changing financial circumstances where a federal district judge has ordered the city back to paying the retiree health care plans that were in place a couple years ago, and it's just a bill that is very, very hard for this community to afford. I really think it's an unfair proposition for the city of Flint's taxpayers and residents and businesses that we're stepping up to try to do so much. We've supported millages, people are volunteering, they're doing everything they can, and yet this general fund, this city general fund, isn't able to provide the level of services that we want.
What kinds of have you had conversations with Mr. Early since he released this budget?
Yes, there have been conversations, and the emergency manager is clear that the city can only spend the resources that it has available, and there's no debate about that. We all agree with that. We're using this opportunity of trying to address the problem now that the alarm bell has went off, the facts and figures have been put out about the impact of the rising pension and health care costs. So now we're working with everybody who's available to try to find a solution. And that's what we're using this month. City Council and I, as elected officials, we're stepping up, talking with Congressman Kildee, talking with our State Senator Jim Ananick and state representatives like Phil Phelps, so that we can find some solutions. That's what we're focusing on for these next couple weeks.
Now, is there any possibility of a helping hand from Lansing?
There is. There was an amendment that was added to the House General Government Appropriations Bill that came out Tuesday night that has a placeholder for additional police and fire assistance to the city of Flint. And let's not forget that the state has been investing resources in the city's lockup facility and with the county sheriff so that we can have jail space available for the perpetrators who were arrested by the city police and the state police and others. So it is a collective enterprise that we're involved in, and everybody's going to have to help. You know, Flint voters have done it with a police and fire protection millage.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, in this situation, almost 3 years under state receivership, there's absolutely a state role in the solution.
Contracts are now being negotiated with police and fire. What do you think all this means for these negotiations?
there are some aspects from those negotiations that are already in this proposed budget, such as all active employees going to the full 20% premium cost share. The city had previously used the hard cap under the state law, and now the shift will be to an 80-20. There's reduced benefits going forward for any new hires. So those key aspects of those contract discussions are already built into this proposed budget.
How united is the city council in opposing these police and fire cuts?
The city council and we have concerns about citizens' ability to pay for city services, especially the water and sewer rates, and also the strength of the police and fire protection services. So we're on the same page now. Over the next 2 weeks, we have a series of at least four hearings, the first one this last Tuesday in Public Works, where we're going through and looking at each of the divisions, the service levels, any general fund contributions, and asking ourselves if that's the right way to use the general fund given our circumstances. We're going to be able to make some adjustments, I believe, or at least recommend some adjustments with our local funds, and then we're going to need some assistance from the state, possibly a couple waivers from the U.S. Department of Justice so we can keep some federal funds flowing into public safety. And if we do all that, then we're going to be in a decent position come July 1.
What is your greatest fear that could happen from losing those public safety jobs?
Now, even before that, my concern is with the perception of what's happening in the city, because public safety is half perception and half reality. So it's very difficult for a community to go through and see headlines of proposed police and fire cuts. Now, that's, again, the reality of the proposed budget and where we are with the city's finances. But I'm afraid that those proposals end up being seen as the only option, and then it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. What we want to do is focus on a message of looking for solutions, working together, and then when we actually get to budget adoption in June, be able to tell a story of what we've accomplished together to try to keep Flint's momentum going forward.
Flint Mayor Dan Walling, always good talking with you. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Finally, if you've ever thought of sending a gift to Governor Snyder, rest assured you will not be the first to have that thought. It turns out the governor's office has kept a log of the gifts he's gotten while in office. The total, over 1,100 gifts. One Tough Nerds received over 400 books, for instance, including Calculus for Dummies. He got the Ralph Lauren sweater our Olympians wore in Sochi, Russia, as well as a 14-karat gold-plated slinky. One of his favorites, though, is a welded sculpture of a brown trout made by some high school students. Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Stateside was engineered by Peg Watson. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening.